Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Saturday was the 10th anniversary of what we usually consider the start of the financial crisis in 2008, September 15th, the collapse of Lehman Brothers that day. 10 years on, many economic numbers are looking pretty good. The president has noticed, of course. Yesterday afternoon, Trump tweeted, "Best economic numbers in decades. If the Democrats take control, kiss your newfound wealth goodbye." Now, even if we ignore the part about Democrats in the midterms, it's hard to impeach the general sentiment. By the most popular indicators, the economy is doing well. The stock market is up, unemployment is low, and the GDP, gross domestic product, which is supposed to measure the size of the entire economy, is up 20% since this point a decade ago. Trump naturally takes credit, while critics attribute the numbers to Obama-era policies. A good president makes a good economy, and a good economy makes a good president. Chicken and egg, take your pick. But for the majority of Americans, says my next guest, these economic numbers don't actually reflect as much reality as we think they do. A decade and 2 days after the financial crisis really hit, the stock market may be doing well, but most people's wealth is not. And one of these says much more about the everyday well-being of Americans than the other. In a column for the New York Times, David Leonhardt argues that financial crises have historically highlighted the need for new measures of well-being, and that after 2008, those new measures are still overdue. Hi, David. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It is always a treat to be on your show.
Is the financial crisis over?
No, it is not over. And so the reason I think if you look around and look at the world around you, let's forget for a minute about economic indicators. Look at the kind of political crisis we have in this country. We elected a racist reality TV star to the presidency, and his presidency is in chaos. Just listen to the people who work for him in the new Bob Woodward book, and in the either famous or infamous op-ed published in the Times anonymously. And I don't know who wrote it, so you can't twist my arm on that. Look at what's happening in Europe in terms of Brexit, in terms of the rise of right-wing parties. I mean, you really see all kinds of anger and frustration and stress. And the financial crisis isn't the only reason, but it is a major reason. And so we see all kinds of ways in which the financial crisis is still with us and the after effects of it are still with us. And so then we should ask ourselves, if that's the case, what's wrong with our indicators that tell us that it's not still here, rather than trying to contort reality to fit those indicators?
So if unemployment is down, the stock market is up, and the gross domestic product, the whole economy, is up, what hasn't recovered?
So what hasn't recovered is the economic well-being of most people. And GDP is a real statistic, and it matters. And the overall value of the stock market is a real statistic, and it matters. But when people hear those on television in news stories, they hear it as being proxies for how Americans are doing. And frankly, that's how the media intends them. And that is much less true than it used to be, because the bounty from our economy goes increasingly to a small portion of the population, a small affluent portion of the population. So while it was true that when GDP rose in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, the ordinary household, essentially all households, if you look at them by economic group, did really well, it's no longer the case. And basically what you have is stagnant incomes, or I should say slow-growing incomes. Incomes are growing a little bit right now. Slow-growing incomes for the majority of the population and rapidly growing incomes for this small subset. In some ways, stocks are the purest example. I mean, if you look at what the stock market has done, it is undeniable. It has come way back from those really scary depths of 10 years ago. I mean, it's much higher than it was using any measure, adjust for inflation, you name it. But But then look at the net worth of the median American household, and it's still down 20%. And the reason is that most American households don't own a lot of stock. And so we shouldn't talk about the Dow Jones Industrial Average as if it's a measure of most Americans' wealth, because it's not.
And listeners, we can take some phone calls for David Leonhardt, New York Times columnist, at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We're also going to get into another of his columns from just the other day called The Urgent Question of Trump and Money Laundering. We talk about collusion and obstruction of justice so much. David focused on the money laundering issue, and I think, especially with the recent development regarding Paul Manafort, who already was convicted of various kinds of financial fraud, the money laundering question may come more to the fore, so we'll get into that. But 212-433-WNYC for David Leonhardt, 212-433-9692. I was really intrigued by one effort to rethink economic indicators that you included in your column. That is how we measure GDP and revise it to reflect income going to the rich, to the middle class, and the poor people, and poor people separately. How would that work, and why would that be good?
It is fascinating. It would be important because, again, when we hear GDP, we assume it's saying something about most people's experiences. And if it's not, we should fix that. And GDP is not a naturally occurring phenomenon. We didn't used to measure GDP. And the effort to measure it came out of the Great Depression when people realized it was important to understand what was going on. And so I think that we should use this crisis and the longer-term trends that contributed to this crisis, like the growth in inequality, to improve our metrics further. GDP was a great advance. Now we should go much further. And there is an effort by a number of economists, Gabriel Zucman, Emmanuel Saez, and the most famous of them, Thomas Piketty, to measure GDP as the income that flows to different segments of the population. So look at how much national income goes to the bottom 10% of earners, the second 10%, et cetera, up to the top 10%. They've done this. They're private academic economists, so it doesn't get nearly as much attention as the government doing it. Plus, they have to use data that they're approved to use, so it has about a four-year lag. But what I find intriguing is that two senators, including New York Senator and the Democratic leader, Charles Schumer, have a bill that would essentially have the government do this. And there's no reason the government couldn't do it, where when GDP is announced, you would get the headline number. GDP grew 3%. You would also hear that for the middle section of our economy, GDP barely grew at all. And for the bottom, it barely grew at all. And for the top, it actually grew 7%, the income flowing to those groups. And I think that would be a much more meaningful way to do it. And I think it's important to do it together. You don't want to do it as some separate release. You want to kind of force us as a society, in the media, politicians, to have one conversation at the same time about who our economic growth is benefiting.
You know, I was thinking about another of your recent columns in relation to this, the one in which you wrote that polarization in American politics, as we usually think of it, is the wrong way to think of it, because it's not both parties are heading to the extremes. It's the Republican Party that's heading to the extremes. But we do now have more of a socialist wing, explicitly self-identified socialist wing of the Democratic Party emerging, pushing things like Medicare for All and federally guaranteed jobs, I think in response to this long-term inequality, looking at the push for something better than just let the market recover in its market ways, and then we'll be in the next bubble, and then we'll, you know, structurally wind up with even more inequality when that bursts. So maybe the Democratic Party is heading more to the left, in fact, and maybe it needs to.
Yeah, I think, look, Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, the former top advisor to Barack Obama when he was president, he's someone that I think a lot of people on the left like to beat up. They have disagreements with him, and so no one thinks of him as some kind of—
They saw him as too centrist, too establishment, too pro-Wall Street, to be sure.
Yes. And he made a number of enemies among the Harvard faculty when he was president there. And he's not the point here, but the point is, no one would see him as some kind of radical lefty, right? And what he said to me recently, I think, is a really good thought. People on the left might disagree with the first half of this, but he said, look, I think that the events of the 1960s and 70s and 80s should have moved an open-minded person to the right on economics. We saw essentially the socialist economies in other countries failing. We saw the policies of LBJ lead to inflation, not just LBJ, but we saw the policies of the government leading to inflation, all kinds of things. We saw the Clinton era where they brought down the deficit and it seemed to spark a boom work. On the flip side, he said, look, I think what's happened over the last 15 or 20 years should have moved an open-minded person to the left, which is we've had a growing economy, and yet it isn't lifting the living standards of most people. And I agree with that. And so the idea that the Democratic Party is moving somewhat to the left on things like taxation, on things like figuring out ways to have the government create good-paying jobs, I think that makes sense. My point in the column in today's paper is the more radical ideas on the left, whether you love them or don't like them, remain not the policy of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party is not trying to get rid of private insurance. It's not trying to take tax rates up to 70%. It's still willing to compromise with Republicans. It accepts science. It's not trying to prevent certain kinds of people with certain skin colors from voting. It hasn't stolen a Supreme Court seat. And so I think the radical party in American politics today is the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party.
That is a list of indictments you just cited there. Stephanie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with David Leonhardt. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to get his insight on a dynamic, which I think you've even discussed on the show before, but to your data about, the gains have predominantly been in the stock market, et cetera. I'm wondering if you could comment on the proverbial Trump voter who has not largely participated in the return of wealth that we've seen, et cetera, and where you think this comes from. And they've talked about it on the show where perhaps it's that Donald Trump vents their spleen, creates the proverbial other. He rattles off their emotional frustrations, and so he's the spokesperson for that frustration. Is it that? Is it that their narcissism prevents them from admitting that they're poor, and so they project into the millionaire they want to be, but really are not?
David?
So I think I'm about to oversimplify, but thank you for the question, Stephanie. Look, there are kind of two kinds of Trump voters to think about. Obviously, there are, hundreds of kinds of Trump voters. But Trump, in the end, won the overwhelming majority of normal Republican voters. So let's remember that, right? He won the overwhelming majority of higher-income Republican voters who almost always vote Republican. What we in the media and many people, and I think your question is focused on, is the swing voter, working class white voters in the upper Midwest, in places like the Florida Panhandle, who voted for Barack Obama, who voted for Democrats in the past, and swung to Trump and helped swing the election to Trump. The thing I would say about those voters is I understand their frustration. They are frustrated that their living standards haven't been rising, that they may not be wealthier than their parents, they may not be healthier than their parents. And I think it's important to recognize that the reasons for their frustration are real. Even if I think that voting for Donald Trump isn't going to solve anything, even if I acknowledge that for some number of those voters it is based in part on racism, I think it's important to acknowledge that the frustration is real, and also to acknowledge that people on the left also vote against their economic interests. There are huge numbers of people in New York who may be listening to the show right now, who may subscribe to the New York Times, who vote for the Democrats, even though Democrats will raise their taxes. And so the notion that people vote against their economic interests is something that happens on both sides. I think the question for Trump's opponents is how to appeal to those voters in ways that make them see, not that they did something horrible by voting for Donald Trump, but that he really doesn't recognize their interests. That's not easy, but I think it's deeply important given the damage he's doing to the country.
And I guess in fairly simple terms, the battle for those voters in economic terms is between the Democrats saying if we have relatively higher taxes and more government programs, that's going to help you out more, and the Republicans saying if we have lower taxes and more deregulation, that's going to help you out more. By the way, we'll have a proponent of more deregulation coming on after you. But in pure economic terms, without all those other social questions and biases and passions coming into play, that's sort of the economic, I think the economic battle lines, you know, in simple terms. And let me go to Rochelle in White Plains. You're on WNYC with David Leonhardt. Hi, Rochelle.
Hi. My point is, and I agree completely, as a New Yorker who votes, I'm extremely liberal and vote against my interests constantly, you know, why do the, you know, what I consider mainstream media continue to cater to, you know, the top 1% of the economy and continue to report these figures that are beneficial to the way Republicans see the world? And why are we not reporting instead on, you know, what percentage of our children are going to school hungry? You know, what percentage of children in school today are getting food in school for free because they need it? You know, how many families are filing for SNAP relief? How many people are being turned away? How many people aren't getting food relief that they need? And, you know, by the way, how are those people in North Carolina doing with their less government now with this storm? And I think it, you know, there's no question in my mind that, you know, if this were the other way around and this were the Republican issue, that they would be battering this home. But, you know, it's this idea that Democrats are somehow nicer, and so we're not going to put it in people's faces like, hey, you know, this is the less government you voted for. So when nobody comes with a boat or a helicopter or a fire truck to pull you out of your house, this is why. Because you don't want to vote for higher taxes, which, by the way, you're not going to pay. I'm going to pay.
Rochelle, I'm going to leave it there for time, but what a great list she gave us of, let's say, uncommon economic indicators that maybe this is a good challenge for you, David, with your interest in this topic and your economics background, or maybe you've done it already and I just haven't seen it. Come up with a list of more accurate economic indicators than the one the business press use all the time, and try to make them, you know, everyday parlance.
Yeah, that's a great challenge. And look, I don't think it's because the media are trying to protect the interests of the 1% or the media is trying to protect Republicans. I think more than anything, it's habit. GDP is a real number. It's reported by the government. We've been doing it forever. The same with a bunch of these other indicators. And the world around us has changed and makes these indicators less meaningful than they once were. And we need to change with it. And Rochelle's absolutely right to point out that we haven't yet. Brian, can I make a very quick response your last point about how the midterms will be fought?
Please do.
So I agree with you. I think the key for Democrats is basically making the economic argument, which is when you look at the polling, most people, including a lot of Republicans and independents, want to raise taxes on rich people in order to have programs that help the middle class and the poor. I think the tricky thing for Democrats is Republicans aren't actually going to respond to that by saying we're in favor of lower taxes on the rich and deregulation. Republicans are going to respond with a bunch of cultural arguments that sometimes are coded racism-coded arguments, but aren't just that. And I think what's going to be hard for Democrats is Democrats have a very hard time not engaging on those issues. But the fact is, if Democrats decide to fight about immigration, if Democrats decide to fight about national anthem protests, which is a terrible issue for Democrats, they will be doing Republicans a favor. And so I think part of the question is how disciplined can Democrats be returning to these economic arguments that unite both their base and large parts of the Trump base, and not getting dragged into these arguments about the national anthem protests and other things that end up being enormous, enormous favors to Republican candidates.
Really interesting point. Before you go, just very briefly, on your September 10th column, the urgent question of Trump and money laundering. Do you see the investigation, especially now that it's going through Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen, moving from collusion per se and obstruction of justice per se to money laundering, or maybe money laundering as the key to the other two?
I think we don't know. Robert Mueller's investigation has been admirably closed door. He's not leaking. We don't really know what's going on there. And Adam Schiff, the Democratic congressman from California, who's really been a leader on this issue, is concerned that Mueller actually isn't looking into the possibility that Trump was engaged in money laundering with Russians over many years. It's possible that it wasn't totally criminal. It's possible that the statute of limitations has expired and that you can imagine Mueller deciding it's not really the focus of his investigation. But as citizens, we should be deeply concerned about it, because if it actually happened, and we don't know whether it did, if it actually happened, it means the Russians have leverage over the President of the United States. And so, unfortunately, the Republicans in Congress have refused to investigate the President. They've defended him. And what that means is that the only hope for having a full investigation here, if Mueller's not pursuing it, is having the Democrats take back the House.
David Leonhardt, New York Times columnist, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.